This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, and in the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk, it is the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Matt and Brett here today. Nice to see you again, Brett.
Hello, hello.
Just FYI, Chicago, I'm coming to you. So it is spring break for my youngest child, and one of us had to kind of do some college tours, and my wife has basically toured every college with the other two kids and so far with my youngest. So I had to kind of, fall on the sword a little bit this time. So I'm heading down to Chicago this weekend. I got to drive through a snowstorm tomorrow, but if I make it alive, I'm going to be joining Patty Vasquez on her show tomorrow night, which I'm looking forward to.
It's going to be fun, yeah.
Yeah,
you're a double dose of Matt McNeil tomorrow.
No, you won't have the regular dose. Todd Mickelson is going to be kind enough for filling us in for my show here the next 3 days. I'll be back here on Monday. But the real fun, you know what the real fun is? Thanks, Wisconsin. I got to drive through a snowstorm tomorrow. Oh, God. And thank God those people don't drink, so that would make it a lot more dangerous on the roads. Oh, God. Isn't Wisconsin the one state we have constantly 97 car pileup? I'm like, Jesus. I'll just take back roads.
Looking to that possibly happen. Hopefully it doesn't.
Yeah. It's
Google Maps ready.
Wasn't
a new route.
Wasn't Wisconsin where they arrested the plow driver for being drunk? That was a few years back. Oh, good. Oh, I'm sure those roads will be great. Not looking forward to that, man. But I'm looking forward to getting down to Chicago and going to a little vacation, a little college visiting down there. And like I said, I can't wait to go see Patty because, you know, Patty's just good people. And Patty Vasquez, of course, we what time is it? That's airing in the evening here at
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. I'm down there at 9 o'clock. You know, she's up here in Minneapolis, St. Paul on 9 o'clock. So it's you know, one twin powers activate. That's what's going to happen there. So looking forward to that. Dr. Joe Eastman calls. He's going to come on in here back half of this hour to tell us how doomed we are as a human society because of now the bird flu thing. Oh, thank God. Oh, God. Patrick Cooligan in the 4 o'clock hour from Minnesota Reformer talking about various things, the news stories they've been covering today. And we'll have another pair of Stephanie Miller tickets to give away in the 4 o'clock hour as well today. I want to start off with, hands down, how much of SCTV did you ever see?
Not much. The only thing I remember is seeing the promos back when I was a kid.
SCTV was brilliant, and I would make an argument, and this is bold statement extraordinaire, the second best comedy troupe outside of Monty Python. I think pound for pound, and sure, guys like Dave Thomas, you know, and maybe Andrea Martin didn't necessarily have the long, you know, TV careers, and movie careers that other ones did. But when you look back on that show, gosh, that show was good. That show was really, really good. A fake television station that were running. To give you an idea how good they are, way before Celebrity Jeopardy and other things, there was a show, they did Half-Wits. That was with Eugene Levy as the host, Half-Wits. And they're all just a bunch of idiots on the show. And that was where that all originated.
Oh, from. That's what I have to see. Because I loved watching the SNL Celebrity Jeopardy, if that's the same.
Yeah, it was basically
style, yeah.
Half-Wits was just a bunch of dumb idiots on this smart person game show, which is great.
Potent potables.
Well, no, it wasn't like Jeopardy.
No, not Celebrity Jeopardy. Yeah.
But you know, they of course had just so many classic bits on there. Martin Short got his start there, which was, you know, Ed Grimley. And I remember watching Ed Grimley on SCTV and saying, how come Saturday Night Live could not? Now, granted, this was in the Saturday Night Live that was what Joe Pesci and, you know, I think, you know, Eddie Murphy had just started up, but it was pound for pound. That wasn't just, it wasn't the strongest lineup they had on SNL. And I was like, how in the world can they get someone this funny? And of course they did. They eventually went and got him and brought him on to Saturday Night Live for that one spectacular Billy Crystal, Martin Short year, which was just amazing. But still, I think they were pound for pound. That's why this hurts. Comedian Joe Flaherty, founding member of SCTV, he has passed away at 82 years old. Yeah, Count Floyd, man. Oh, God. His daughter said Tuesday that he had passed away following a brief illness. Flaherty was born in Pittsburgh, spent 7 years in Second City in Chicago, so shout out to the Chicago brethren down there. He is a proud alumni down there. He moved north of the border to help establish the Toronto outpost of Second City, and that's where they started the SCTV, Second City Television. He went on to star alongside John Candy, Catherine O'Hara on SCTV, about a fictional TV station known as Second City Television that was stacked with buffoons in front of behind the cameras. Flaherty's characters included Guy Caballero and vampiric TV host Count Floyd. Oh, Count Floyd. We've got a scary movie for you. Terms of Endearment. What? That's not scary. Oh, God. He won Emmys in 1982 and 83 for his writing on SCTV, continued to work in TV and film for the decades afterwards. He was introduced to later generations through memorable turns as a heckler in the 1996 Happy Gilmore and an old-fashioned dad in the TV comedy Freaks and Geeks, which ran from 99 to 2000. He was part of that, too. Flaherty maintained deep ties to Toronto, serving as an artist in residence at Humber College. This is from the daughter. Dad was an extraordinary man known for his boundless heart and unwavering passion for movies. From the 1940s and 50s, cinema wasn't merely a hobby for him. It profoundly influenced his career, particularly his unforgettable time with SCTV. He cherished every moment spent on the show. So proud of his success and so proud of to be part of an amazing cast. He was so good. Forget Rick Moranis was on that as well. Catherine O'Hara was so good on that show too. John Candy was so good on that show. It was just amazing they had that much talent together. He passed away once again, 82 years old.
He's 82. I would not have pegged him for being 82.
Well,
when I've seen him, yeah, from some of those other shows you were mentioning. Wow, I'm thinking, oh, that was him.
So,
yeah.
I thought about that. I said that at the beginning, I said the SCTV might be the second best skit comedy group of all time behind Monty Python, because I don't think anything tops Monty Python. Monty Python was just pure brilliance. But, you know, Kids in the Hall was quite good. They've had a few seasons of, you know, Saturday Night Live, which were really good. But even then, there were some dud shows and just, you know, some of the... And I think maybe that's part of the reason that toughness of working with a guest host. I mean, I would make an argument that when you know, 10 years ago when Saturday Night Live was loaded to the gills with talent, that they had some good cast there. But yeah, I think pound for pound, you look at SCTV and it's hard to think of another one that outside of Monty Python that was better. And just brilliant. And Flaherty was great. And Count Floyd, go watch Count Floyd. I think he does show up on Half-Wits. I think he does show up on Half-Wits, if I'm not mistaken. And wasn't he part of 3D House of Pancakes on there as well? I think he was on the 3D House of Pancakes. Do you want more syrup? Do you want more butter? One of the greatest, you know, oh, God, that show was good. That hurts, man. I'm 55, man. That one hurts. Oh, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. The Conservative Daily Caller publication, by the way, I'm going to have one of these in the local hour coming up in the 4 o'clock hour as well. The Conservative Daily Caller publication has retracted an article that claimed President Joe Biden was responsible for enacting a policy banning religious-themed Easter eggs as the annual White House Easter egg roll. In a correction that appeared in the story, the publication acknowledged that what assorted media fact-checkers had pointed out, the prohibitions on religious-themed Easter eggs artwork at the event stretched back decades. Following the publication of this article, the Daily Caller became aware of additional context that undercut the central assertion of this article and its newsworthiness, the publication wrote. The ban of religious symbols on eggs as part of the White House Easter egg contest has been longstanding, dating back decades, and the Biden administration did not make any modifications to the rule. While the caller did not explicitly state at any point the rule was new, this additional context rendered the main thrust of the article misleading to readers, which was reasonable to have come conclusion that the rule was new. No, you didn't say it was new, but you did everything in your power to imply it was brand new. Why is Joe Biden doing this? Which is a clear implication. It's a new thing. The article itself, and by the way, and this is the point was this, the Daily Caller knew it was a lie. They knew it was a lie. They did. But you see, it's like when Trump tweets out something, it's not about truth. It's about basically code to the people, start squawking this, because what the Daily Caller does is become the enabler, for lack of a better way, the dealer that deals the misleading drugs out to the rest of the Republican Party. Many Republican politicians, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, accused Biden of waging a war on Easter, despite the fact that Biden, a practicing Catholic, paid tribute to the holiday this week by saying Easter reminds us of the power of hope and renewal, sacrifice and resurrection, but mainly love and grace towards one another. How dare you, Joe Biden? You and your peace and love, where does that come from in the Bible? Oh, that's right. And by the way, mind you, this is House Speaker Johnson knows exactly. I guarantee you someone in his staff said, hey, before you go say this, before you say anything here, this is not him. This is Nixon, I think, was when they put this into place. Didn't matter, because he said, because at that point, what happens is the Daily Caller gives them carte blanche to say, see, Joe Biden's evil. And no one drags Mike Johnson out and says, wait a second here, Speaker, none of your staff cleared the fact that that happened. You went out and ran with it. In promoting the Daily Caller article, Johnson also accused Biden of trying to replace Easter with Transgender Visibility Day, a day that is scheduled for March 31st every year since its inception, and that it just happened to fall upon Easter Sunday this year. By the way, what was it in 2029? Watch out. Joe Biden's already planning on April's Fool's Day Easter. How dare he? Anywho, the Biden White House has betrayed the central tenet of Easter, which is the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Johnson wrote on Twitter, banning sacred truth and tradition, blah, blah, blah. As you can tell, this is, you know, it's what it is these people are just looking for the reason to basically go out and echo it. And now, I guarantee you, when you confront Johnson on this, he'd say, well, I just was going with the Daily Caller. I didn't know. You're the Speaker of the freaking House. You should have known this. Someone should have fact-checked this for you. That's a garbage excuse, but you are a garbage speaker. We'll take a break. Come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. The Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Well, in what is just a horrible story, President Biden expressed condolences to Chef Jose Andres to his call on Tuesday for a vowed urge to Israel to protect aid workers after seven of his staffers at Andres World Kitchen, Central Kitchen, were killed by an Israeli strike in Gaza. Monday's deadly strikes have sparked backlash around the world and inside the White House. They led to the suspension of maritime aid route through Gaza, which is the key to international humanitarian relief efforts. Israeli President Isaac Herzog's office also said he spoke with Andres on phone to offer sincerest apologies for missiling them and the tragic loss of life. Herzog promised a thorough investigation. They meant to do this. And I'm sorry. Okay, and before anyone says I'm going to get too harsh, once again, I'm going to repeat what I've said about this from the get-go. After what happened when the Palestinians attacked Israel, Israel definitively had a right to strike back, and they did. And they did with force, and they did that with the aggression, and they did that. But it has gotten to a point where clearly what they're doing now is just kind of clearing out the entire Gaza Strip, and they're going to basically, my guess is going to be settlements are going to be put in there, and right now they don't seem to have any solution for the Palestinians outside of killing them, which is what they are doing, and they're doing basically with a vengeance. They are so trigger happy. I've got to remind people that two of the hostages that the Palestinians had were released, and as they were walking back to the Israelis, they killed them, even though they were waving a white flag. They killed their own hostages, the people they're trying to get, their own citizens who are hostages who are trying to get back to their own lines. This has been a recurring problem. And once again, to a point, I will say this about Israel. It's hard when the enemy that you have is stationing themselves in hospitals, in schools. I can understand that. And, you know, to a point, that's deplorable. And if they're just sitting and launching rockets at you from a hospital, it becomes very difficult to argue that Israel can't do anything outside of just watch the missiles land on them. But at the same time, the heavy-handed nature of this, to where it's not sending in a team to the hospital, it's just aiming a bunch of missiles at the hospital, and if it hits the maternity ward, who cares? That's the problem, and that's what I have a problem with, a lot of people have a problem with. This is a heavy-handed approach that needs to be pulled back. And here you have one of the greatest volunteer organizations. Andreas has been amazing across the world. He has gone into conflict zone after conflict zone with his people, and they have been able to feed the neediest people out there, and there is clearly a need in Palestine. I have zero doubt in my mind that Israel intentionally targeted them. I have zero doubt in my mind. Because within the Israeli government right now is this mentality that any aid to the Palestinians has to be stopped. And that is not a fringe mentality. That is the mentality. And so I have zero problem thinking that the Israelis intentionally targeted them and realized after the fact, like after shooting their own citizens as they were trying to get back to their own people, that oops, and realized, wait a second, this is a much more of an international crisis than we had. So when he says there's going to be a thorough investigation, there's not, because they knowingly did this. That is my complete total belief. They knowingly, intentionally attacked this group that was out there just trying to feed the hungry. The world kitchen workers had been transporting supplies between a landing area on the Gaza coast and a warehouse in central Gaza when they came under fire from the Israeli Defense Forces. Despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving. So once again, they had coordinated this, and yet they still went out there and just attacked them. Why? Because there is a large portion of the Israeli government right now that does not want any humanitarian aid getting into the Palestinians. And if they die, they die. And that is the mentality they've got at this point. And I don't want to hear, I'm serious, I don't want to hear about, well, you know, what happened 40 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years. I don't. You guys got your revenge. You guys got your payback. You guys went and leveled the Gaza Strip. At this point, it's intentionally being evil for evil's sake. And the fact that you went out there and the World Central Kitchen guys had coordinated with you didn't matter. We're going to kill them. And you did. And you did. They were leaving the warehouse when the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza by the maritime route. The organization said it was pausing its operation in the area after the attack. So as far as Israel is concerned, mission accomplished. The United Arab Emirates, which is the main funder of the organization's aid route, also announced it would pause its involvement in the maritime aid corridor to Gaza until Israel provides assurances that the aid workers will be protected. Once again, mission accomplished for Israel. They don't want people helping the Palestinians, so. A U.S. Canadian citizen and Palestinian citizens of Australia, Poland, and the U.K. were all killed at the World Central Kitchen. White House spokesperson John Kirby said in a briefing to reporters that the Biden administration is outraged by the strikes, is waiting for findings of the preliminary IDF investigation. Well, they had clearance to do this, and the Israelis still attack them. What else do you need? Kirby also stressed the U.S. expects more thorough investigation of transparent conclusions and accountability. Sure. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed Israel had carried out the attack and said it had been a tragic accident. No, it hadn't. This is what you guys want to do. You do not want humanitarian aid getting into the Palestinians. And so you kill a few people working in a food kitchen. Who cares? You stopped what you wanted to stop. People are starving. Yeah, this is getting ludicrous at this point. This is getting absolutely ludicrous. Andreas called on Israel to stop this indiscriminate killing and stop using food as a weapon. The Spanish chef has close links to members of the Biden administration and has become a highly influential voice of humanitarian issues. And his crew, I remember I listened to the Smartless podcast with him, which is old. It was one of the first ones they did. Old when I say it's like 3 years old. And that they respond when people are hungry. And if you know anything about me and my particular, just my religious faith, I think one of the most important things for me is feeding the hungry. I know that there are people that are not going to be happy with this, but I mean, when you coordinate through the Israeli military and say, we're going to drop off this humanitarian aid, and the second you guys start dropping off the humanitarian aid, the Israeli military hits you and hits you hard and kills a bunch of your workers. The whole goal was to stop the humanitarian aid, because there's a lot of people in Israel that do not want the humanitarian aid to be there. And it sounds like basically unless every Palestinian is dead, they're not going to stop. And I just don't know what else we need to do there. So 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Dr. Joe Eastman when we do return. Broadcasting in the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk and in the afternoons on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. Dr. Joe Eastman is our COVID modeling expert, our infectious diseases expert, our just the guy that I go to when I was like, what's going on, man? And he is kind enough to help us. I will put a link out to his blog. If you're not following it, you need to. A lot of great information there. He has worked with a ton of different organizations. And once again, Dr. Joe, who is the one that you're... Well, you just got courted by another group that wants you to come help work with them, correct?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's fun, though. Keeps me busy, keeps the brain sharp in my retirement, so what the heck. I work for the World Health Network and kind of do their modeling stuff. We get some exciting stuff going on there. And then a really well-respected doctor asked me to consult on a cancer and COVID project that he's proposing right now. So, yeah, lots of good stuff.
Well, let's.
And then we got the avian flu.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the avian flu. Let's, since we talked to you about COVID and stuff, let's talk about that. Where is it right now? It seems like we are in that time of the year where things start calming down. And once again, I mean, it's a very different world than it was 4 years ago. But at the same time, we did have a spike this year. Has that spike gone down at this point? Started to recede?
Yeah, we went from well over a million new cases today to currently we're around 500,000. It's going to continue to bottom out probably around 400,000 and then start a slow climb up again, possibly into May. That was my last forecast I got out, and I'm looking at other people's forecasts right now, and they're kind of coming to a similar conclusion. What's really getting worrisome is the number of long COVID cases are just across the globe. In Australia, they just did a study, and there's one out of five people with long COVID in that country. The U.S. just had a new one after sitting around 14-15%. Now we're up to 17% in the States. So that is a problem. It's a slow-evolving problem that we don't have medical treatments for in a lot of ways, but I think we're starting to see a little fruits of the research community in terms of possible treatments, repurposing old drugs and things like that. So it's getting a little bit better. So, but still, this is a big problem, not only just health-wise, but for our economy, of course. So we can't lose our focus on COVID either at this time.
Well, and we had talked for years about the long COVID, and the fact is we don't quite know what the full extent of the consequences are. What we do know is that it does attack the brain, and it does seem to cause a plethora of symptoms and problems that were there. You know, it sounds like, because I know I saw the study that you're pointing out, that they're starting to find drugs that are seeming to have some success with long COVID. But at the same time, they're also discovering new problems with long COVID that they didn't realize was actually because of long COVID.
Yeah, I mean, we're identifying well over 200 symptoms of long COVID now. The list is just absolutely incredible. And I got a little personal thing of about 14,000 research articles, and you know I can't possibly read all these, but I kind of go through them and pick out the main details and such. This is something that we really got to focus on, because it's only going to get worse when we're sitting at levels that are above our very first spike from COVID. That's our low point now, so. You know, if we're getting up around one out of five people with this affliction, the post-acute sequela, it's a very serious problem, and we really have to focus on it.
Is there, how many diseases affecting humans have, we'll just go with the American numbers, 17% of American people, is it 17% of the American people or 17% of the people that have had COVID, that have long COVID?
17% of the population.
17% of the population. Is there how many other diseases have that kind of reach within the population?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I couldn't answer that off the top of my head, but I know this one is a standout in terms of that. You know, in a lot of times, like you say, it takes a while before we realize all the different pathways that this thing is taking. And the scary thing right now is this darn virus, it's a competition between the human immune system and the evolution of the COVID, and it is putting so much of its resources into immunity escape and such that it's reached a scary point. In fact, it's gotten into our bone marrow, where you have the naive cells that need to be trained to fight off new infections and such, and we don't have an infinite reservoir of those, so we're using these things up at an incredible rate, and slowly your immune system is just not going to keep pace with what is going on.
So we could have a disease-caused immune deficiency issue.
Exactly.
Dear Lord.
We're seeing signs of it everywhere, and all, you know, like the measles, all these different things are starting to increase in numbers, and they do have different causes, you know, less vaccination for the kiddos and things like that that should be done, and they are easily addressable if people just get their act together.
Well, I'm terrified. I'm going to do the rest of the show in a fetal position underneath the desk here. when you talk about the number of cases that we were having, how do you know what the percentage of the asymptomatic was? Because once again, I'm not saying that there aren't people that are getting the old style condition of COVID, but I think a lot of people are getting a milder version and they just don't even realize it.
Yeah, I've seen estimates like in the United States and actually across the world, right around 60% of the cases are asymptomatic. So, you know, over half the new cases, they're walking around, they don't know they even got it. And they're not going to take precautions naturally. And then you get the CDC saying that, hey, you're asymptomatic, but if you haven't had a fever in a day, you're cool. Go ahead and go back to work. That is the most crazy thing I've ever heard, man. I, 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 my jaw dropped when I first read that. And it's really scary. One good thing, I just saw a study yesterday that they've identified a possible mechanism for when the SARS-CoV fuses into your cell. And there's two different cleavage mechanisms that help it get into your RNA and such. And the two different mechanisms, it's possible that one of them is the asymptomatic cause and the other is the symptomatic cause. And what that means is maybe we have a possible way to break that link. It's going to require a lot more research, but I thought that was a bit of a positive development in this dark time right now.
What new strains of COVID are giving you raising an eyebrow? I mean, is there any new ones right now on the horizon that you're seeing in other countries that are starting to, they're getting out of control there?
Yeah, we're starting to see a lot more of the recombinants. The new one just popped up, I saw today. It's called XBV, not a lot of data on it, but the indications, they're developing software now that can predict the immune escape and the transmissibility of the darn virus through a thing called protein language, which is really cool. I wrote about that, I think, in my last Substack. And that gives me, they can actually predict what is going to come in the future. But to get back to your question, the other one is KP2. One of my colleagues is really flipping out over this thing. It has a 300% growth advantage over the JN1s that are currently the dominant strain right now. In fact, there's nothing else left. It's all JN1 right now.
Really?
And then we're going to go into the recombinant phase with those, and also this whole tendency to outpace our immune system through its evolutionary mutations. We're not winning this battle. We're falling further and further behind every year.
Well, it is. We should make sure, though, we say, so far there's been a lot of proof that you keep up with your vaccinations, and it sounds like there's a new one out. They want to at least people to go back and get the latest version of the vaccination again. If you stay up to date with that, that's at least a fairly decent, aid to a person to where they won't, once again, it's not saying you won't get sick, but if you do get sick, it's a much less likely chance you're going to get a serious problem, correct?
That's precisely right. And we just got to get back to masking. You remember after the Delta surge, and we were up to 68% in quite a bit of this country that were masking, and we need to get back to that. It's going to prevent all kinds of other problems, respiratory problems and stuff, especially for the kiddos. And I was just reading a recent study where it just definitively showed our mitigation procedures for preschool children had just a massive impact on reducing the infections in our young ones. So, there's a lot of variant neutral things we can do, and we're not doing them. And until people wake up, or until something else hits really strongly, I don't see it changing in the immediate future.
Well, you got idiots basically saying, I refuse to sit next to someone wearing a mask on a plane. You're like, okay, really? That's, by the way, that's the big, that guy's going to be begging for help when all of a sudden he gets really sick. And I guarantee you that. That was that guy from Yellowstone or whatever it was. Anyway, Dr. Joe Eastman joining us. Let's get into the main course today. Apparently, you have been talking. Now, you and I have talked about chronic wasting disease, which is a disease that's running in the deer population, and there's a potential fear that that could jump to humans. But avian flu, once again, has been showing us it's got some resiliency to be able to jump. You pointed out to me, I think it was 2 weeks ago, you sent me an article saying avian flu has jumped to cows and to goats. I think it was goats first, and now it's in cows. Now we got a case from cows to humans, and it's one case. It doesn't look like it's going human to human yet, but still, avian flu is no longer a bird issue.
You're spot on. I mean, if you think about it, with the massive outbreak in the dairy cattle that we're getting, it's not like there's suddenly flocks of birds descending on our cows right now. It all points to mammal-to-mammal transmission. And that's the first step for it to jump to humans and cause human-to-human transmission. In the avian animals, you're looking at a larger than 50% mortality rate. Of course, they don't have a doctor they can go to and stuff, but that is just totally frightening. They wiped out a huge population of seals in the Arctic and
seals
Antarctic. I mean, it's in all kinds of animals. If you look at it over the past several years, it's like, good gracious, the gray seal, harbor seal, raccoons, foxes, skunks, possums, mountain lions, brown bears, bobcats, black bears, big cats, and coyotes.
Oh, my.
exactly. And all those are mainly in the northern part of the United States. So.
Well, okay. I'm going to ask you this, then. Is it going raccoon to raccoon, seal to seal, cow to cow, or is it they're all just getting exposed to a bird that's got it, and is the transfer from bird to mammal to individual mammal, or is it now mammal to mammal outside of the humans?
In some of those species, it appears to be between the species itself.
Oh, great.
Exactly. It's still airborne, the droplet borne. But if you see a dead bird, run.
Okay. Yeah, it's not 1930s where, a toy. No, leave the dead bird alone. Dr. Joe, hold on. We got to talk more about this. Sweet Lord, we got to talk more about this. Dr. Joe Eastman is our communicable disease and COVID expert. He's kind enough to join us here on a Tuesday, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on WCPT 820 and on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Hey, Mr. DJ, put a record on. I want to dance with my baby.
It's the Matt McNeil Show. Dr. Joe Eastman from the World Health Network, kind enough to join us today to talk about this. Okay, so I got to get back to the avian flu thing here. So we have a disease that was in birds. It's now gone from birds into mammals. It's affecting multiple different mammal groups. It is moving freely between those mammal groups. It's not like you still have to find a bird to infect every raccoon. The raccoons are infecting themselves. We have one human case. It's the second human case. This case clearly seems to have come from cows that this individual was around, and he got the avian flu from that. How, I understand part of this is just a huge speculation. How close are we to having human to human, expansion of the avian flu?
I think we talked about this as long as 3 years ago. And I said I think it's inevitable within the next 10 years. I think the time span is probably shorter than that now. I wouldn't be surprised within 5 years if this happens, if not less time. And, that's really scary. And the thing that is really irks me is I'm seeing some of the early health guidance, like put out in Texas and stuff, and they're still going with this 6-foot radius stuff, and it just boggles the mind. I'll put it that way. I mean, what in the heck are they thinking about? We saw this before with COVID, and they finally figured, it's airborne. That sucker can travel all throughout the building. If it does happen, we really got to buckle down in a hurry, because we have no idea what the mortality is going to be from this. I suspect that we'll have an initial trouble treating it. And you saw with the death rates with the early COVID when it first struck here were almost 10%. So we've got it down less than 1% now. But the symptoms of the avian flu are very similar. But the only one that pops up that I can see is different is seizures. They They're showing seizures in people infected with the avian flu. And then a prevalence of conjunctivitis, which is basically just your eyes going really red, and there'll be another pathway for infection, you know, through an optometrist or whatever. All these things have their own little niches that they carve out. And this one, if it happens, I'm really nervous, and most of my colleagues are much the same right now.
But compared to COVID, COVID came out of kind of really nowhere, and it was a very quick ramp up. We've known about avian flu. We've known that this has got a chance to do this. It, as you said, I mean, it's got a 50% mortality rate in birds, but birds don't have doctors. And it sounds like this guy down in Texas, they've been able to treat him with antibiotics. It's been able to, they're getting good results there. You know, it does feel like, because we have the ability of doctors, as long as a bunch of idiots don't sit there and say masking is worthless and don't get vaccinated, we should be able to weather this somewhat better than the birds, correct?
Yeah, so I pray for it.
Yeah.
you know how we've rolled with COVID, so
yeah.
I have my doubts in many ways. If the mortality rate, though, is like it was before, and this thing hits like COVID, you're going to see a lot more need for refrigerator trucks at the beginning, and that's when people really panic, when they have the visuals. You know, it was like when the Canadian wildfires came into New York, all of a sudden masks were sold out in all kinds of places, and they could see it, you mm-hmm. know, and when people see it, it starts to tick in their brains a little more, or if their kids are starting to get infected by this stuff, it really starts to freak them out too. So, yeah, we don't know. It's an unknown.
But it is something I think we can say it's going to happen at some point. We are going, we can see this cab coming down the street. It eventually, avian flu will eventually jump person to person. And right now might be a good time to, hey, you know what? Maybe I should pick up some masks. Maybe I should kind of get, you know, the stuff that I need, you know, have some emergency food supply, stuff like that, in case it does go wrong. Correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It does have a reproduction number very similar to the early stages of COVID, is the best I can find in the literature. So it is highly, highly contagious and airborne in that respect. So, and it also, you know, lives on surfaces, seems to have a longer sustainability on surfaces. So, yeah, I hope people take this very seriously. And like you say, it's not a bad idea. I got two big boxes of N95 respirator masks always in the house.
Uh-huh.
And I think all people should have those.
And wear one on a plane. And once again, reiterate too, with COVID, go get the latest vaccine. Whatever it is, it's now time. You can get another scheduled shot. Go get it, because that's the best way to get through that, correct?
You're darn tootin'.
All right. I will let you, we shall give Chicago a lot of praise. The Bulls came into Minneapolis, and Dr. Joe is also our Minnesota Timberwolves fan, but the Bulls did, they took care of business. They came into town and they beat up on the T-Wolves on Monday.
That Caruso, man, his defense was incredible, and boy, could he shoot that three ball that night.
Should I be concerned that the T-Wolves kind of have this tendency? They beat Denver in Denver, and then they come back, and what on paper is a worse team, you know, around a 500 Chicago club, they lose at home there. I mean, when it comes to the first round, will these guys with the T-Wolves, will they pull it together?
I know it. I'm fearful, because a lot of teams at the bottom are playing their best ball of the year right now, and Anthony Edwards is kind of in a funk right now. He had bunch of turnovers. He couldn't even make layups that game. It was like, I don't know if he needs a rest or what. And then you get the Towns factor coming back in probably in a couple weeks. And how's he going to mesh back in? Because there is a pretty good chemistry going on with Connelly and Rudy, and you know, Nas is still doing his thing, and there's a lot of good components. So
and
I am fairly confident.
And once again, praise to Chicago. The Bulls are going to make the playoffs in the East, so it's you know, and praise to the Bulls. You guys got the nice win there, Dr. Joe. I'll post the blog out a little bit later for all the health information. As always, my friend, thank you very much, and you take care. Okay.
Thank you very much, Matt, and you have a good week in Chicago.
I will. Chicago, talk to you tomorrow. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next. Hour two of the show here on your Tuesday. Matt and Brett here. And a reminder here, Todd Mickelson is going to be filling in for me for the next few days. I am going to be heading on out of... to do some college visits with my youngest daughter. We'll have to see how this goes. She's already told me a few colleges. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. And I can't see me rooting for that school. Definitely not going to get that t-shirt, you know. But we'll have to see with her education. Fine. But Todd filling in, by the way, I'll be on Patty Vasquez's show tomorrow because I'll be down in Chicago. I just got to get through apparently a blizzard.
Yeah, we just heard the news there. We're talking about, you got a task in front of you trying to get to Chicago.
Well, it sounds like by like 4 a.m, most of it, I mean, I'm not going to leave until like 8 tomorrow morning locally. So
it'll probably be a couple hours into it before you start hitting the bad stuff.
I would hope so. I mean, as long as I get to the Hixton Travel Plaza. Have you ever eaten at the Hixton Travel Plaza?
I have not, no.
That's a solid meal right there. And it will fill you up. You know, make sure you have an alternate driver so you can get a nap. We'll have to see how this goes. I am slightly concerned about how this is all going to go. But I don't mind. It's just going to be me and my daughter and, Chicago, man. Good town. I've already got my traditional Chicago food layout done. As a matter of fact, there is nothing funnier than, and it happens when people call here. It's like, hey, where should I go eat? Let me tell you all the places I'd go. Same thing happened. It's like, oh, go to this place. Got my Chicago style hot dog, deep dish pizza, all set to go.
Yeah, you need those two for sure.
Oh,
he's
probably
going.
We have to go to the restaurant from the Bear. Apparently, my daughter has, you know, because Johnny Abs, Chef Abs over there. He apparently she wants to go to that. So a Chicago Italian beef sandwich. Come on, man. Twist my arm. Okay, fine. Fine. If you make me. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. So here we go. I don't know if you saw this story. This will bring me the news. Suspect wanted by police in Mankato caused thousands of dollars of the damage to newly planted trees in Mankato. The Mankato Department of Public Safety said it received multiple reports of criminal damage to property on Balserzak Drive and Pole Road at 6:53 a.m. Callers indicated that many of the city trees bordering those two roads had been damaged. The officer found 45 damaged trees. Video surveillance showed a suspect intentionally damaging the trees and then leaving the area on foot. The city estimates it will cost about $16,000 to replace the trees. I'm hoping they find this guy and that they have to replace him. They say the suspect then went to fire station number 3, damaged some parking lot signs, and threw a pole at the front door. And authorities are asking for help if you know who the person is. There's photos with the story. I'll post that a little bit later on. But yeah, the first thing I want to say is, and I want to be, you know, very clear, this person clearly has some mental health issues. You know, you don't do stuff like this with, you know, you've got some mental health issues for sure. But at the same time, you still have to be somewhat, you know, held accountable for your actions. So I'm hoping that that's indeed going to be the course of action there. I get so upset when I see that, though, because we do these nice things to try to get trees planted and stuff, and then to see it cut down or damaged. So there's a park right next to our house where the real little kids play baseball. I mean, it's got not the biggest outfield. And so it's the real little kids that still don't understand. I can't run to third base. I have to run to first base, that sort of thing. Some idiot went out there and did donuts out in the field. Some idiot went and did that. And I was just like, okay, what's wrong with you? What is wrong with you? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I want to also mention, you know, I'm going to be taking a flight later on this year. And I want to salute the fine people at Sun Country Airline, because I am flying Sun Country Airline. And when you fly, what airlines do you fly?
Pretty much Delta, but occasionally I will do Sun Country.
Delta has been god-awful expensive. I mean, I want to be honest. The tickets I bought with Sun Country, if I bought with Delta, would have been at least $1,200 more. At least. Sun Country, it's a decent flight. Does it have, like, the full video television setup in the Sun Country planes? No, but I don't care. I mean, I'm not taking a flight so I can watch a movie. I only have 5 million other options to do that if I want to do it. As a matter of fact, I could download the movie if I really wanted to and watch it on my phone while I'm on the flight. Ta-da! Science. But now, apparently, Delta has noticed their pesky little MSP neighbor, and apparently they're going after him. But they're doing it the way Delta would do it. If you're at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, you need to know about Delta's attempts to compete with Sun Country Airlines' cheap fares. Kyle Porter, the thrifty traveler, a Minnesota-based website that monitors local airfares, say that what may seem like the lowest fare may not be the case, and the cost of an upgrade can hit harder than you expect. Now, because that's one thing. Have you noticed if you go to like a Delta and you try to buy a flight, the first thing they say is, well, do you want your bags to go with you? And you're like, well, yeah. Well, that's another $300, you know, that sort of thing. I'm not saying that. Of course, your bags will go with you. But you are talking about the seats in the back of the plane by the toilet back there. That's where those are the seats we're talking about. Potter says Delta's bare-bone prices for basic economy tickets have you paying extra for everything. SkyMile points aren't even provided. It will cost you hundreds of dollars more if you want to upgrade. That's what I noticed. If I didn't, you know, if I wanted to not be strapped to the cone of the plane, you know, that was an extra $100. Although that'd be a cool way to go. I mean, it's a little cool up there. I hope they let me bundle up. And hope the hat doesn't fly off because my arm's going to have to be strapped.
Well, you get a convenience fee if you want some secured straps to keep you on the nose of the plane. Another $300.
We got dental floss. That's our basic economy. But we do have some more sturdy bungee cords if you upgrade.
Maybe a seatbelt will be thrown in too.
We noticed that Delta was doing something very interesting. They were, you know, slashing the prices of their cheapest and fairly stingy basic economy fares to match or even undercut Sun Country. But in doing so, Delta was still charging an extra $300 in some cases for the main cabin. Where else are you flying if you're not in the main cabin? Are you on the toilet? Are you in baggage? Well, I mean, you just get a few of those big lumpy bags. You can turn it into like a beanbag chair. Just lie the you'll be fine.
That's a good point. Where else? Yeah, you're not in the cockpit with the pilots.
Where are you in the? Yeah. I thought everyone was in the main cabin. They're better fares that include things like seat assignment, you know, the ability. I did it one time just because I didn't have any other option. I did it one time with three kids on a plane, and I got three seats together, one seat kind of kitty corner to my seat. And so I put my oldest child in that seat, me in the seat behind him so we could keep an eye on each other, and then the three sat together. That was the only way we could do it. And they're like, you know, and I just remember it being kind of a miserable experience because I was like next to Johnny Coffee, you know, coughing the entire time. Not coffee as far as coffee drink. I'd take that. But, you know, the guy coughing like, you know, I got a lung that wants to leave his body because that's a delightful experience. Sun Country does give flight points for anyone who has signed up for their frequent flyer program. Potter says the best advice is to check complete cost with the add-ons and compare the final cost between Sun Country and a Delta fare. The difference, Potter said, can add up to hundreds of dollars, especially if you're traveling with a family or a group. I would agree with that. That's one thing I can't stand about modern flights is the way that it does. They just pile on and pile on and pile on. Do you know who I took the last time I went down to South Carolina was American. And we don't do a lot of American. We got United here with Chicago. We get a lot of them. But I don't get a lot of American. That was a pretty good flight, man. Now that's, I think that, you know, you're doing the hubs thing. So we had to go to South Carolina. The main hub was Charlotte. So we had to go to North Carolina to take a flight then to South Carolina. But I thought that was a decent airline, man. I didn't have any problem with American, and it was actually relatively affordable. It didn't seem to be doing the Delta thing. So
yeah, not surprised they're doing that with how many mergers they've been through over the years. That
it does seem like they're kind of like, all right, now, you know.
They're going to say, where else are you going to go? That's their slogan.
It's like, you take the bus if you don't like us. That's the Delta Airlines.
What are you going to do, take the bus? Yeah.
I like Sun Country. I fly Sun Country. And I do like that terminal out, the what's we call it, the Humphrey Terminal. The Humphrey Terminal. I like the one out there. That's not a bad terminal. And, you know, depending on the situation, it's a far easier terminal to navigate than the main one at MSP.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're talking Terminal 2, right?
Yeah.
The technical name it is, yeah.
Well, Terminal 2 or Humphrey.
Oh, it's still Humphrey in my mind.
Sun Country Terminal.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you don't have those godforsaken long walks there. You don't have that gate C-49, you say. All right, where's C start? Oh, okay, over there.
Gate is always the furthest one away, no matter what it is.
And the walking sidewalks aren't turned on. Thanks for that, by the way. Thank you for that. Needless to say, my complaining is over. I'm thinking about taking a flight now that I have to drive through Wisconsin in a snowstorm. We got Patrick Cooligan. Speaking of our snowstorm of journalistic integrity, it is Patrick Cooligan on the worst transition ever. What are you and Patrick talking about today?
I was going to say, you set me up for the complaining thing. That kind of was a transition into what we're talking about with Patrick Cooligan today, because we are going to be talking about affordable housing and how oftentimes you get local residents who mount opposition to affordable housing projects, and that leads to the city canceling the project. And there's now a bill at the state legislature which could prevent some of that from happening. So we're going to be talking about that as well as some other topics as well, including the Supreme Court case that they're hearing here in Minnesota with this right-wing group trying to overturn felons being able to vote. Fortunately, it doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
That is the stupidest legal argument I've ever seen in my life. I'll save it for you guys.
Yeah.
That is the stupidest legal argument to try to strike down those voters. Patrick Cooligan with Brett right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And right now we are joined by Patrick Cooligan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you give them a follow for the latest in Minnesota news and politics and all of the great journalistic work they do. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today. Always good to have you back on.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So today we have a number of topics we're going to be talking about, including affordable housing and what the Minnesota state legislature might do to try to create more affordable housing projects, at least at the local level, since oftentimes you have local governments sometimes scuttling these projects. We'll get more into that in just a few minutes. We'll also be talking about the Minnesota Supreme Court and how a right-wing group is trying to challenge felon voting rights being restored to Minnesota. That's something that happened last year. And we'll also be talking about how fewer people died on Minnesota roads back in 2023. But first, let's go back and talk about what's happening with affordable housing and this project specifically in Edina, because I think this will kind of give context to what we're talking about. So in the city of Edina, there was this affordable housing project that was going to provide 89 units that was going to be built by this company called Sohelm, which is a Minneapolis-based developer. The project was basically fully funded thanks to help from the Minnesota MFHA, the Minnesota Finance Housing Agency, and initially it appeared that the city of Edina was going to be on board as part of the city's comprehensive plan since the project fit into the comprehensive plan. But then things changed. And now these fully funded units are not going to be built. And that's largely because neighborhood opposition started to mount, as you might expect sometimes when you have affordable housing projects. And that led to the project largely being scuttled thanks to some actions taken by the city that kind of added red tape to it. So, as I'm curious, Patrick, what happened and how did this project end up getting scuttled? Because it seems like a story we often see in Minnesota where an affordable housing project looked like it's going to get green lit, and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of opposition from citizens and the city backtracks. So walk us through what happened in this Edina project.
Yeah, so cities have a comprehensive plan, and the plan did call for for housing there, but the zoning regs had not been updated to be consistent with the plan. So they were going to need a rezoning to build housing on the site. And then some residents, as we so often see, a minority of residents of Edina, but a vocal minority, started to stir up opposition. They got 1,000 people to sign a petition, which, of course, sounds like a lot, but it's still a very small minority of people who live there, and they opposed the rezoning. And then there was another petition from a nearby townhome association, which called for something called a small area plan, which is like another regulatory regime that would be specific to this portion of Edina. Once that was established, they start this 12 to 18 month process to plan for future development of a multi-acre area that included the proposed site. And the city council said, yeah, we want that too. So once they do that, now your construction timeline is off, and you don't get those federal tax credits that you need to finance the project. And it was basically done. You know, I think that it's a story that's it's so often we've heard it so often that it's kind of almost a cliche when neighbors get riled up and stop a project. In this case, you have a real good indication of what they were against, because originally the developer wanted to do market rate apartments, meaning, you know, probably kind of expensive. This is Edina, after all, expensive apartments. But when interest rates went up and the market conditions changed, they went out and find this financing for affordable apartments. Now, all of a sudden, the fine people of Edina were quite concerned about noise, traffic, property values, all the stuff that people usually complain about. Thankfully, at the legislature this year, they're considering a number of bills that would really override some of these local zoning rules that so effectively keep projects from being built. And I think what Zach, the writer, did here effectively is he says, look, you've got kind of two tracks here, two separate policy issues. One is just affordable housing. We don't have enough of it. We don't build much of it. The other are these land use rules. And, you know, a lot of people have been focusing on that this legislative session. Going to help make it easier for developers to build, but the two are actually related because often it is those land use rules that are used to prevent the building of affordable housing, you know, subsidized affordable housing. And even if when they do get it built, all these rules often mean we don't get as much bang for our buck as we could otherwise. So it's just another reason that the legislature ought to be taking a good hard look at these local land use rules and the way in which it has prevented development, not just a market rate housing, but also of affordable housing.
Yeah, I want to get more into what the legislature is proposing and the response that some local cities and local governments are responding to with this. But this is kind of a convenient out that cities can often use. And I'm not just singling out Edina, where they can say, oh, well, this project looks great to bring in all these affordable housing units, but oh, the zoning requirements don't quite line up and it doesn't look like the timeline's going to match up. And it can kind of satisfy both parties with the developer. They can say, well, we wanted these units built, but it just doesn't fit our zoning permits. And then the angered residents, well, they don't get the project built in the first place that they didn't want, which is kind of a good way to squash it. So it's a convenient kind of out for at least the local level to squash these projects. But yeah, the legislature looks like they want to change things in terms of what these local cities can do.
Yeah, they want to stop cities from blocking some denser housing like duplexes and townhomes in neighborhoods everywhere. And then also, if you're near transit stops or commercial areas, you need to allow larger apartment buildings. I mean, these are sensible reforms. There's another constant. Difficulty for developers is minimum parking requirements. At the same time that we're trying to get people out of their cars, we're also demanding, these huge minimum parking requirements that drive up the cost of development and prevent more building. They're also considering a rewrite of the state building codes to allow some taller buildings with a single staircase. The reason we had required multiple staircases in the past is a safety issue. But they think it can be done safely, and it would allow much more efficient apartment construction. And then there's a lot of construction materials that cities will require, really for aesthetic reasons. And I think we want beautiful cities, but we also want enough housing, and that's another issue that's mandate that's been used as a cudgel to prevent development in cities, especially in the metro and especially in the suburbs. So the basic idea here is we're deregulating and giving folks more power to do what they want with their own property. And so that's part of the reason why this has become attractive to Republicans and is really one of the most, if you love bipartisanship, you'll love this effort, because there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats that have come together on this issue.
Yeah, and that leads me to my next question is how are local governments responding to this, and specifically the Minnesota League of Cities? Because oftentimes when I've talked about the Minnesota League of Cities in past when I've been on the radio, usually it's been them opposing Republicans using preemption against local districts. But now, of course, with the DFL in control of the state legislature, it proposes kind of an interesting dynamic, because as I imagine, the Minnesota League of Cities probably is not very much in favor of this becoming law and taking away some of the local control that governments have when it comes to approving these types of affordable housing projects.
Yeah, they hate it. And there's a journalist who pointed out on Twitter recently that a memo from the city administrator in Shakopee to the council members there was really using some alarmist language. He said, local city governments across the state of Minnesota are under siege. And that sounds really extreme. While current legislation being considered by state government seeks to strip basic and fundamental controls that cities have used for decades to ensure the viability of their communities and will destroy a city's zoning power. That was particularly interesting to me because Shakopee last year, as the Sahan Journal reported, got caught caught with their hand in the cookie jar when the reporter did a public records request and got emails showing that they were really working to prevent an affordable housing complex there in Shakopee. So the usual response is local control, and they act as if that sort of ends the argument. And I don't know why it would. There's all kinds of ways in which we don't want local control. If we're going to be hyperbolic about it, we can point to racially segregated zoning that was very common until it was overturned by the Supreme Court. And then even after that, neighborhoods and property owners would put racial covenants on their properties. So just because something is local control doesn't mean it's good or just. And so I hope the legislature is taking a hard look at these reforms.
Well, you can read more about what Zach wrote over at MinnesotaReformer.com, titled Minnesota Lawmakers Aim to Stop Cities from Killing Affordable Housing. It's an interesting read because we have, like so many other states, an affordable housing crisis here in Minnesota, and this could be one way to possibly mitigate that. But as you'll read in the article, there's definitely some opposition. I want to briefly touch on two other stories that you guys were working on over at The Reformer, and this one has to do with this right-wing group that is seeking to basically stop felons from having their voting rights restored. Because what happened last year was that 55,000 Minnesotans who were convicted of a felony and are no longer in prison are allowed to vote while still on parole, probation, or supervised release. Basically, prior to the change that was made back in 2023, felons had to wait until they were off probation, parole, or supervised release and had to pay their fines or restitution. And basically, given that Minnesota has a very lengthy probation sentencing system, that could oftentimes mean years for many convicted felons. So what was happening was that we were going to have Minnesota felon rights restored, but Instead, we have a challenge from this right-wing group called Minnesota Voters Alliance. And the grounds they're challenging this on are really interesting because to me it kind of sounds like they're splitting hairs. But when it comes to legal language, well, sometimes that's what you have to do because what they're arguing about is that the Minnesota legislature, and correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, is that they're arguing that the Minnesota legislature was restoring one right instead of multiple rights. And that's kind of the crux of their argument, saying that, well, you have to restore all of their rights instead of just a single right. So this whole language appears to be splitting hairs, but it is very important with this case of the state legislature.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. You're the lawyer, right? But I just don't know that the court is going to go for it.
I don't. Yeah.
I think because the court itself, if you remember, the Supreme Court ruled that the legislature could prevent people. This is back before the law passed last year, and sort of laid out how the legislature could, if it wanted to, restore people's voting rights. And the legislature, that was just weeks before the legislature did so, and the legislature went on and restored voting rights. So it's the same Supreme Court, more or less. And so I just don't think that they're going to react very well to this kind of, as I called it, grammar neener. Yeah, I think that the court said, here's how you would restore voting rights, and the legislature did it. And I'd be very surprised if the court were to overturn the legislature's ability to do that. Also, I mean, you know, just from a policy standpoint, when people get out of prison, when you want them to really reintegrate into society, one of the ways that is helpful is if they are civically active. I mean, it's intuitively, it makes sense, and I think it's been shown to be true. And so we want people to get engaged, and so it's good policy. You know, why on earth would this group want to prevent these 55,000 people or what approximately get back into civic life? And I think it's, to me, it's pretty obvious. Yeah. It's because they're afraid that those are 55,000 Democratic votes.
Yep, pretty much hit the nail on the head right there. And from what we're seeing so far, and you can read more in Michelle's article over at MinnesotaReformer.com, it does sound like the justices are rather skeptical about some of these arguments from that right-wing group. But make sure you go read more about that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. And briefly, I want to touch on one more thing you guys worked on over at The Reformer, and that has to do with what Christopher Ingram wrote, talking about how fewer people died on Minnesota roads in 2023, which sometimes kind of flies in the face of what we often hear from other media outlets saying, well, Minnesota's roads are as dangerous as ever. Well, the data shows that's not necessarily the case, no matter how you measure it. Looking at highway deaths, they've receded after kind of spiking during the pandemic. Highway deaths are at near record lows comparing decade after decade. In fact, they're way down looking at the 2020s, while the highway death rate has fallen by nearly 90%. So I'm curious, did anything jump out at you looking at what Christopher was able to research? Because I'm glad he's able to put together these numbers, because it kind of sometimes flies in the face of the narrative we often hear with what's happening with Minnesota roads.
Yeah, I think we were all a little frightened at once or twice on the roads.
Yeah,
the last couple of years. But what to me, this is such a great story, because when you look at the historical sweep, what it really shows is a huge public policy success, and I don't think we talk about that enough. And what you see here in this one of his charts is this. I mean, 1,000 people. I think it was per million vehicle miles. Deaths in Minnesota vehicle accidents.
Yeah, yeah.
You had 1,000 people dying, you know, around in 1970. And of course, far fewer people driving and vehicle miles traveled in those days. And what happened around these years? Well, Ralph Nader came on the scene, and he really forced through the regulatory and legislative process a lot of safety improvements on the automobile industry, and it worked. We're a lot safer on the roads. You're much less likely to get hurt or die in a crash. The cars are safer much safer, and hopefully we're drinking and driving a lot less as well, and that's due to the better enforcement that took place starting I think in the 70s. So it's a good news story when you look at the historical sweep, and I think it really flies in the face of this kind of notion that well, it doesn't matter what we do, just throw up our hands. When in fact, if you put the right policies in place, you put the right laws and regulations in place, you can have a lot of success in making something a common human activity safer.
Yeah, I encourage you to check out that chart. Yeah, it's highway deaths near record lows, which does show the deaths in Minnesota vehicles from 1950 to 2023. And it is just insane how in 1970, yeah, we were up near 1,000 deaths per 1 million, and now it's down to about 400, which is a near record low level. And as you said, many of those drops started happening as we started changing our policy, whether it was drinking and driving, seatbelt policy, and so forth. So yeah, I think it does show a great sign that we can have policy success when you, well, commit to those types of policies. But you can read more about that with Christopher Rote on that data over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Koulikan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Hey, as always, thanks for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's give away a pair of tickets, shall we? We shall. Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberal Save the World Comedy Tour is coming to the Pantages Theater on April 13th. You got Steph, you got Fugelsang, you got Sparks, you got Frangela, you got Cliff Schechter coming into town for this, and you could go see it yourself. Caller number five, Brett. Caller number five. At 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Caller number five, you'll win yourself a pair of tickets to go see the Sexy Liberal Show. Good luck. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Do you remember last hour where I was talking about a little bit about, you know, I was going to, you know, I think I was talking about the Daily Caller story and how I was going to, they basically had to recant that. It seems our own large anamorphic jar of Elmer's glue, Tom, has also been doing the lie because, and by the way, and once again, I want to make sure we're very clear on this. There is no excuse whatsoever for a senior Republican official in the House, in the Senate, to not know the truth. They knew the truth. They basically just, so Tom Emmer knowingly lied because he's a horrible jackass. Because once again, the Transgender Day of Visibility, he blasted Joe Biden on social media over the weekend, claiming he declared that Biden had declared Easter Sunday as Transgender Day of Visibility, which happens to fall on the same day this year, while also falsely claiming he was banning children from using religious symbols at the White House Easter egg art contest. Both of those are lies, which would take a competent staff member seconds to verify. He didn't even try because it wasn't about the truth. And this is what you need to know about Tom Emmer. Besides that, that is one pasty white dude, man. That is, you know, you know, Edgar Winter looks at him and is like, wow. I mean, you are just a lying sack of meh. The House Majority Whip posted his criticism on Twitter and doubled down with the claim of the tweets this week from his campaign account, sharing a Fox News article where House Speaker Mike Johnson questioned whether Biden knew what he was signing, you know, the signing with his proclamation. Once again, they intentionally, this is why I ripped on the Daily Caller earlier, is because Fox News, the Daily Caller, didn't do this. All they had to do was do a basic fact check. And it's like, oh, okay, no, the Transgender Day of Visibility has always been March 31st for the last, you know, 15 years. And that the religious symbols ban on Easter eggs, that actually has been decades old. And even under Trump, they went into this. And once again, under Trump, they celebrated the Transgender Day of Visibility. Under Trump, they prevented kids from putting, you know, overtly religious symbols on Easter eggs. They did this. That doesn't matter. They went with the lie. This is the leadership of the House. And they knowingly, they could have fact-checked this. They decided not to. They decided to run with this. Because the entire point of what Tom Emmer is doing is not about the truth. He just wants to put it out there for his supporters. You need to be angry. And he's lying to you. And I can't... I don't know how to tell you this, guys. They do not have your best interest at heart. He is overtly lying to you because he needs you angry and mad and miserable. He doesn't want to make your lives better. Because if your lives get better, guess what? You're not going to vote Republican. So he has to constantly tell you about doom and gloom and oh my God, there's a transgender Easter bunny. He knowingly lied about these things. Let's talk about the character of the man. That is a piece of crap. All right. He's the quality of the man. His parents did not raise him well. He clearly wasn't a good college student. You should know how to do a basic fact check, you moron. But you see, that's the point. It was never about the truth. It was only about, let me scare you with the evil Joe Biden. Because you know what? Tom Emmer needs to apologize. He won't. He's a coward. He's a weak man. These are the guys that daddies beat it into him. Don't you ever apologize to nobody. And they don't realize that doesn't make strength. That makes psychopaths. What makes strength is people that can say, you know what? I screwed up. I apologize. That's a real man. That's a real individual. And so he won't apologize because he's not a real man. He's just a lying jerk. He doesn't care. And I cannot press this enough. If you are a supporter, he knowingly lied to you. He knowingly lied to you just to make you angry. Tell me, why are you guys voting for these guys again? Tax cuts, they don't come to you. Those go to the wealthy people, and you get told, you need to work harder. Healthcare, they're trying to take that away from you. Quality education, they want to kill the public school system. Roads, unless it's a road to a wealthy person's house, they ain't going to pave it. Why do you vote for these guys again? Oh, that's right. The only way they can get you to vote for them is to constantly lie to you. And the truth is, I think a lot of you people know that they are lying to you. But you're just so terrified of admitting the fact that, wow, the people I've been supporting forever, they're just nothing. They're garbage people. I'll come back to this in a second. We do have our winner here of the tickets.
Yeah, we do. It is Don from Minneapolis.
Don from Minneapolis. Congratulations. You will be enjoying Sexy Liberal. Do we have the tailgate party set up? Do we have that click and you can buy the tickets for that yet?
Yeah, that is up and running now just as of this afternoon. So you can purchase those tickets as you wish.
All right.
Go to that pre-party. It's going to be fun.
It's on the rocks on Nicollet Mall, 13th and Nicollet. We're going to be out there before the event. Then, of course, there's a link on the webpage for you to go get the tickets to Stephanie, the Liberal, the Live Nation stuff, right?
That we yeah, it's all on the same post, yeah. So if you want to get one ticket, one of them, you'll find a way to get both the show and the pre-show.
Beautiful. Look forward to that. Look forward to seeing you all out there at the Sexy Liberal Show. And once again, I want to make sure that I'm not going to be here for the next few days. Todd Mickelson will be here. Todd will have a pair of tickets to give away over the next few days, so make sure you're listening to Todd through the end of the week here, right here on AM 950. Anyway, let me get back to the lying Elmer's glue tub that is Tom Emmer. This is what Emmer wrote. It's sad yet disturbing. It's entirely possible Joe Biden forgot or didn't realize he was declaring Easter Sunday as Transgender Visibility Awareness Day. I want to remind you, he was lying when he wrote that. He knew Transgender Visibility Day was always March 31st. or if he didn't, it would be something that he could easily check before he accused the president of the United States of doing something he did not do. He joined other prominent Republicans in criticizing the move, his attack on Easter. Emmer is serving as Minnesota's chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign this year and lying. His office didn't immediately respond to requests for comment because they know he was lying, and they're a bunch of freaking cowards that are basically snickering. We said what we're going to say. But will any of them apologize for lying? Nope, because they're all horrible people. Your parents are all crying at the pieces of crud that you guys have turned into. Seriously. It's the only way you can get people to vote for you is to lie. And of course, then no, this is about you guys. You can't win, so you just have to make stuff up. Not because it makes anyone's life better or anything, but just to anger and make people angry. That's all you're doing. And you won't apologize for it because you're the worst human beings on the planet when it comes to stuff like this, to politics. You have nothing there that you want to do to help the constituents. You just need to keep them afraid and angry all the time. It's sad. While Biden did issue a proclamation on Sunday to mark Transgender Day of Visibility, it was because the annual March 31st celebration date happened to land on the same day as Easter of this year. The date of Christian holiday changes each year, something that apparently Tom Emmer doesn't understand as a Christian. It fell on the first Sunday after the full moon that follows the spring equinox. International Transgender Day of Visibility has been held annually. For 15 years, Biden has marked the day on March 31st every year since he became president. It was celebrated for all four of Donald Trump's presidential years. Biden, who is the United States' second Catholic president, posted on X separately to mark both occasions, saying millions of transgender and non-binary Americans should be treated with dignity and respect. He also wished a happy Easter to Americans gathering in churches and homes around across the country. Republicans, including Emmer, then also lied again, saying Biden had recently prohibited children from using religious symbols at the annual White House Easter egg decorating contest. Emmer repeated the claim in a post on Monday, citing the Daily Caller article that has since been retracted. Because once again, what was the point of the Daily Caller article? To basically give these guys the springboard they could lie from. And once again, he's Tom Emmer. He's like the third most powerful Republican in the House. He could instantaneously fact check this. He didn't because he was lying. But the minute the Daily Caller gave him the cover, he's like, well, I read it in the Daily Caller. Well, why didn't your fat white ass get off your damn butt and go over and check? Oh, that's right. Because you didn't care about the truth there, Elmer. He does kind of look like the cow on the bottle. You didn't care. You only cared about making sure you kept lying. That's it. The American Egg Board, which I'm guessing Tom Emmer hates, has partnered with the White House to put on the contents for nearly five decades. It's refuted the claim, noting the federal guidelines prohibited them from using favorable to any religion at the event. This has been the case for years since the Nixon administration and in including all of the Trump administration. The Egg Board and other commodity boards are prohibited from discriminating in all programming activities on the basis of religion, political beliefs, and all other stated categories, said Emily Metz, the president and the CEO of the American Egg Board, in a statement to the Washington Post. And once again, both of these very easy to check facts for the third most powerful Republican in the U.S. House could have been checked, but because he did not care about the truth, all he cared about was basically trying to make his supporters as angry as possible. And the Minnesota Six, they've gerrymandered a district to where he'll win it. If there's any justice on this planet, they would bounce him because you know what? He's not there to help you. He's basically there to scare you and keep you angry all the time. That's it. That should be the Republican Party mantra. He's pathetic. I'm calling you out, Tom Emmer. You're pathetic. Now, prove me wrong. Apologize for both of your lies and say, hey, maybe I should have done some basic fact checking. You can do that, and I'll apologize. I will apologize to you if you apologize for calling out Joe Biden. But we already know you're not. You don't have the courage or spine or integrity to do that, do you there, Elmer? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McMillan Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McMillan Show. I'll give Racket credit here. They call out the Star Tribune as the editorial board. They basically put out Thursday, Minnesota must legalize sports betting. A Strip reporter, Rochelle Olson, didn't note that reporters have nothing to do with the paper's opinion section, though. So the pro-gambling editorial pays lip service to those most vulnerable to gambling's addictive lure, but mostly encourage lawmakers to join the club of legalized sports betting in the legislative session. Why the word benefits is referenced five times throughout the specifics are in short supply. There are a lot of reasons why you shouldn't. The piece does acknowledge that Star Tribune stands to realize some of the benefits of sports gambling, suggesting those rewards will mostly be reaped by those who are monetized gambling infrastructure. The richest line comes towards the end. It's not the job of the Star Tribune editorial board to advance the company's business objectives. Well, keen media observers will likely recall the Viking Stadium debate in the early 10s, in which the Strip editorial board lobbied hard with the eventual U.S. Bank Stadium to be erected at the Metrodome location, which happened to be include land owned by the newspaper and adjacent Strip-owned parcels, whose value skyrocketed when the downtown set was selected. Those five blocks were unloaded for a reported $38.5 million in 2012. And it should be noted once again that and that's just for the owners there, the owners of the property, how they benefited from this. I'll make sure I point out as well, when it came to the U.S. Bank Stadium, every outside of Royce, the only sports guy in town who had the guts to call out the cost of that stadium was Patrick Royce. Everyone else was like, you got to build it. Our town will be inferior if we don't have a football team. You got to build it. The same people that when you said, hey, we're going to give $30,000 to the Guthrie Theater, we'd be like, you're wasting my taxpayer dollars. We're all of a sudden asking for what ended up probably being close to $2 billion with all the Super Bowl enhancements and stuff that we had to do. So that's a good investment. Yeah, that team's just spectacular. How many Super Bowl trophies we got over there now? We got them piled up out there because we got so many cents. Because stadiums get you championships, man. That's what they said. Stadiums get to championships. No, the Star Tribune will make a mint just in ads for gambling. I mean, for God's sakes, I'm watching. I'm at the Y. I'm running, and they got ESPN up in there. They've got entire shows dedicated to gambling on events. It's gamble. And no one wants to sit back and say, should we be doing this? They all are sitting there saying, we want some of that coin. Bling, bling. So, yeah, I agree with Racket here and give Racket a lot of credit. They went out into calling out the Star Tribune and saying, you guys don't try to act like you guys don't have a horse in this race. You guys clearly do. And, you're going to get some benefits there. And, yeah, you seem to be downplaying the negatives. So, hey, I am gone till Monday. Todd Mickelson will be filling in the next few days. I'll be on Patty Vasquez's show tomorrow night, so listen for that at 9 o'clock. Have a good one. Till Monday. See ya.